This is the podcast of Theophilus Church. For more information, visit our website at theophiluschurch.com.
So we are reading from Colossians chapter 4, starting at verse 2. Devote yourselves to prayer, being watchful and thankful, and pray for us too, that God may open a door for our message, so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ, for which I am in chains. Pray that I may proclaim it clearly as I should. Be wise in the way that you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Grab a seat, please. Beautiful. Every year, we take some time, and this is going to be in line with what we've done in the past, but at least the last 2 years, we've taken the first couple years out of the, or the first couple months, first couple weeks, out of the term, out of the year, to actually invite you, invite us as a church to actually participate in a given discipline. Last year, as many of you will recall, because we brought it up just so many times in a redemptive way, we talked about Sabbath keeping for basically a whole year. Although we didn't preach on it every week, we started in September, and we invited you over the course of the year to try out this principle of taking a day a week and resting with God. And I'm amazed at I was just doing kind of an informal count, and I know at least 50 people in this room who a year ago were not taking a day of rest a week and who are now. And I celebrate, man, that just so deeply, the willingness of you and so many of us to actually take this idea of grace in our calendar seriously, that God's grace isn't abstract, it's rooted in our calendar, and that is what the Sabbath is it's grace scheduled, so to speak. And this year, I, you know, to no end, have really wrestled over the course of the summer and even last year to think through what in the world is going to be our discipline this year. And I continued to get this strong sense by, I think a lot of it has to do with just my relationships with so many of us in the room and noticing some cultural changes that are taking place in not only our church, but other churches as well. I've noticed in many cases some of us feeling, and maybe this is your experience, feeling very, wow, that was junior high, like cracking of the voice. That was so weird. By the way, we had a vacation last week, and we went and spent a week in New York City, and we got a chance to hang out for 4 days with Anna and Russell, who are from our community, who are planting a church in Brooklyn, and they are just, I think you would call it, they're killing it. Unbelievable. God is just, I have to report that to you. Unbelievable. We get to participate with their church plant, and I'm actually dreaming up next year taking a team out there to support them for a week, so keep that in the back burner. But one thing I've noticed is for many of us, as followers of Jesus, while we may believe very deeply in our hearts and we have this strong compassion towards others that are following Jesus, and we certainly are desirous to follow him, for many of us, we feel incredibly ill-equipped. And not only ill-equipped, but often we feel just uncomfortable, if not hostile, towards the idea of sharing our faith with other people. And I think a lot of that is a shame complex that the church is in. By that, I mean, I think a lot of us for a long time have felt like the church has done a lot of really bad things. And I'm the first one to stand up here, having studied my history books, to recognize that the church has done a lot of really nasty things. The church has done a lot of really wrong things in history. But that doesn't mean that we don't have a voice. And it doesn't mean that we don't have a message. Because friends, to be a follower of Jesus, to be a person who desires to follow him, actually means that we have, in our heart of hearts, we have in the core of our being, this thing that we call the gospel that we actually believe changes people's lives. The good news of Jesus, friends, changes people's lives. And I feel at times so cowardly and so afraid how in the world am I a witness to this thing in such a way where I'm not making Jesus look really bad? How do I do that? And so Cameron and I prayed, and I feel like this year we're supposed to spend some time and talk about the discipline of witness and what it actually looks like in a really beautiful way, not perfect, but in a beautiful and meaningful way. How do we actually witness to Jesus in our city in an appropriate and grace-filled way? There are going to be two groups of people in this room. Basically, we all break it down into one. Group number one is going to hate that we're talking about this because we're scared to death. And I know I'm talking to a group of people who live in Portland, and friends, most of us live in neighborhoods around here. We live in the city. We feel as though, could the church actually have a voice in a culture like Portland? And we feel almost afraid to say anything. And then there's, on this other side, I'm very clear and I recognize the fact that we actually have in our midst a number of people that don't identify as Christians and are here exploring what it means to become a Christian. And it's going to be profoundly, it could be profoundly awkward for you to sit in the room and listen to a bunch of Christians talk about how we're going to get you to become Christians. Okay? And you know what? I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to take a gamble. I'm going to risk something here. I actually think that if the church talks about how we witness to Jesus in an appropriate way, that is in itself a witness. Meaning this, if you're not a Christian and you're sitting here and listening and you're wondering what does it mean to be a Christian, and you're going to listen to us talk about how we want to help you become a Christian, it is my hope and dream that it is the very way that we preach Jesus, it's the very way that we witness to Jesus that makes you want to believe, that helps you want to believe. It's beautiful to me that in the Bible, do you notice that God never at one point in the Bible, does God ever speak his own language? Nowhere in the Bible, and if God did speak his own language, what would it sound like? I can guarantee you it wouldn't make sense to you. God never speaks his own language in the Bible. In fact, in the Bible, God always opts to speak the language of the people that he loves. Why does God do that? Because God is a loving God. God is like a good parent. In fact, I think of Acts 27, where Paul is recounting his conversion story, how he became a Christian. And he's talking about what Jesus said to him when he became a Christian. And he has this line. He's reporting what Jesus said to him. And he says that Jesus had said to him, "Paul, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? For it's hard to kick against the goad," which is something Jesus had said a few years earlier. And you go, what in the world does Jesus mean when he says it's hard to kick against the goad? I actually don't even know what Jesus meant when he said that. But I know this. I know that that wasn't the first time in history that those words were spoken. In fact, those words were first written 100 years before Jesus even came along, by a Greek poet. And what's incredible about that is this. Jesus, when he speaks to Saul, is willing to quote a Greek poet in order to get his idea across. And the point of that is this, friends. The point of that is this. God always wants to speak our language. He wants to speak on our level. He doesn't want to blow past us. He wants to speak on our level. Because God is a good parent. And he wants us to understand, he's so graceful, even in the way he talks, that he always speaks on our level. He always speaks on our level. And the problem with the church for 2,000 years, friends, is I've worried, do we actually speak on the level of the people around us? Because Jesus would. Jesus, if he was in Portland, friends, he would talk the kinds of things that Portlanders care about. Jesus would speak our language. And that's actually what we're going to read about today, is I want to talk about conversation. I want to talk about spiritual conversation. And I want to talk about what it means to be a Christian and learn how to have conversations with other people about God and about Jesus in such a way that everybody walks away going, that was a positive conversation. The problem is, friends, as Christians, for too long, we have been counting conversions. And we need to start learning to count conversations. We need to start learning, celebrating the fact that we even had a conversation. We spend all of our time trying to celebrate the fact that the multitudes have come to believe in Jesus, and we've forgotten to celebrate the simplicity of a conversation. God celebrates conversation. Three things in our culture: politics, money, and religion are three things that come Thanksgiving, none of you are going to be able to talk about at your family gathering. None of those things. You can never talk about politics, money, and religion. Why? Because the devil has done a phenomenal job at taking three of the most important things and making them things that we can't talk about. And how sad, because maybe there's nothing more important than politics, money, and religion. Why in the world has it gotten to a place where Christians feel so stifled to be able to share who they are? Why do we feel in so many cases that we can't, and I'm going to use the language of what that's going to make sense to so many of us. Why do we feel like we cannot come out of the closet? Why? You know, I was reading this fascinating book a few weeks ago about civility in our country. And you know, it used to be, some of you are going to be blown away by this. It actually used to be like 50, 60, 70 years ago. I know, this is going to blow your mind. The Democrats and Republicans actually used to be like civil. Did you know that? Read the newspapers. It's crazy. They actually like worked together and like they disagreed certainly, but they actually worked together. They had this thing called civility. They actually were willing to like listen and disagree and come up with, you know, ideas that they worked together. And you go, oh, wait, what a wonderful world that would be. We don't have that really anymore, do we? We disagree. The difference is we disagree, but we don't have any civility. We have almost no civility in our culture. I was reading this little book about this guy who had a theory about why that is. Why in the world do we not have civility? And he was talking about, his argument goes that incivility, and maybe a stretch the timeline, but there's truth to this. He was saying that incivility, in his mind, goes back to about the early 1970s. It may be, anybody in the room older than that may go, it was pretty bad back then too. But this guy says it actually, the roots of it was late 1960s and early 1970s. And he argued this. He argued that it all started, incivility started, with air travel. And he said this. He said before 1968, before 1969, when air travel was something that everybody did, lawmakers would be elected into office and they would go to Washington, D.C., and they would live there all the time. And they would stay all weekend long. They would be present. They would stay in Washington, D.C., and they would be there all weekend long. And he says, you know what they used to do is on the weekends, what would lawmakers do when they weren't in session or whatnot, is that they'd go out to the bars. And they'd go drink with people from Senate, Congress, whatnot. And they would go and they would have drinks with people. And this guy was saying, when you look at sort of the histories of Republicans and Democrats years ago, they actually used to go out and like have drinks together. They used to actually be friends. They used to look each other in the face and say, like, oh, you're a real human being. And he said, everything changed when we invented the airplane, because here's what changed. On the weekends, and it happens now, lawmakers, you know what they do on Thursday nights, Friday mornings? They all fly home. And they don't spend the weekends in Washington, D.C. anymore. And he was saying this. He was arguing that incivility began the minute we stopped hanging out with each other. There was a study that came out 3 weeks ago in the New York Times. Did you read it? Half of Hillary Clinton supporters do not know one person who's supporting Donald Trump. Half. That means five out of 10, one out of two. Half of every person who's gonna vote for Hillary Clinton does not know one person who's gonna vote for Donald Trump. And I'm gonna guess the same as the opposite. Half of the people who are voting for Donald Trump don't know a Hillary Clinton fan. The problem in our culture, friends, is we've stopped sitting down with one another. We don't see each other as humans anymore. We've lost our ability to just hang out. We don't hang out with our enemies anymore. Why? Because we can go elsewhere. We don't have to spend time with people that we don't like. We can live in places where we don't have to. And friends, I actually think the Church of Jesus is to be the one place in our culture where the Christ-like civility that Jesus lived. Do you notice that Jesus is always disagreeing with each other, yet everybody knows that Jesus loves them? Do you notice, again, I said this a few weeks ago, Jesus never once in the Gospels, never once says, I love you. But everybody knew he loved them. Jesus embodied this way of living where he could even disagree with people, but they knew they were loved. Jesus knew how to have good conversation. He knew how to talk to people. And for many of us, we don't even have those dialogues. We don't talk about religion. We don't talk about money. We don't talk about politics. Why? Because we've got so many bad experiences of it going south. Friends, I got to tell you, the devil has won. The devil has won. If we have no space in our world to talk about things like religion, because what we think about God is really important. Let's talk about conversation for a few minutes. What does it mean to be able to have a conversation? What does it mean to be able, when you live in a neighborhood, to actually live in conversation with your neighbors, to know people and be able, maybe even talk about God with people? How do we do this? How can we share in conversation faithfully as witnesses of Jesus to those around us? I want you to notice on the sort of the first thing that Paul does here. Do you notice this? Paul says, devote yourselves to prayer, being watchful and thankful, and pray for us too, that God may open a door for our message so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ for which I am in chains. Listen to that again. Devote yourselves to prayer, being watchful and thankful. Paul is going to talk to us about conversation. He's going to say, listen, when you have conversation, we want you to season it with salt, always full of grace. But before you do any of that, you got to pray. Devote yourself to prayer. That word devote is a very heavy word in the New Testament. It's a word of giving yourself over to uncritically. Don't even think about it. Just give yourself to prayer. Be watchful. Be thankful. Notice what Paul is saying here. He is connecting this idea of being a witness for Jesus, being a witness in a place of Christ, and prayer. Notice that relationship. You want to be a witness? You want to have good conversation? You got to pray. Notice Paul does not say that the key to witness and the key to good conversation is taking that perfect apologetics course. It's not learning the art of rhetoric. It's not learning the best way to win an argument. He doesn't say that the best way to have good conversation is to even, I believe in Bible study, but he doesn't say here that if you want to be good witnesses, your first step is you got to memorize the book of Matthew. He says, you want to be a witness? You want to have a good conversation? You got to pray. Is he serious? If we want to be witnesses, are you being serious right now? Then we're going to start with prayer. Honestly, of all things, is that what we need to start with? Prayer? The answer is yes. The numbers in the early church are staggering. One particular historian says that, catch this, in the year 100, there were in the realm of about 30,000 Christians. Okay, in the year 100, 30,000 Christians. I mean, that's a lot of Christians. 30,000 Christians is still a lot of Christians. But then, take it back, in the year 300, best estimates are that in the year 100, there were about 100 Christians. In the year 300, catch this, there were somewhere in the realm of about 30 million Christians. Think about that. We would call that positive church growth. That's incredible. Think about those numbers. From 30,000 to 30 million people in just a 200-year time frame. I mean, that's just remarkable. And can I sort of illustrate for you the kinds of people that bore this message to the world? All the earliest Christians, it turns out, when you look at the sort of early church writings, almost all of the earliest Christians, you know who they were? Most of them were slaves. Most of them were freed slaves. Most of them were, in that culture and time, nobodies. And that is, most of them were women. In the early church, 75% of the early Christians were women. And in that culture, in that time, of course, women were sort of seen as the lowest part of society. These were people who were orphans. These are widows. In fact, women were so attracted to the church. They were so attracted to the church because in that patriarchal culture, the church was one of the only places in the world where women were seen as people who were created in God's image. They were people who were respected. They were even people who had witness. They had prophetic voices. There's incidences in the New Testament where they stood up and offered prophecies. They prayed in public. Friends, these women were given a voice. Slaves, women, the nobodies. The earliest church, friend, was for nobodies. It was for nobodies. And the church just spread like fire. And it was not, friends, I can tell you, it has nothing to do. When Peter stood up and preached in Acts 2, the very first sermon, he didn't stand up and preach and have power because in between denying Jesus and 40 days later at Pentecost, he went off to Bible college and learned a few Greek words. And it wasn't because he learned the art of rhetoric in those 40 days. It wasn't because for some weird art. I mean, this guy was a fisherman, a nobody. This guy was in that culture nothing. He denied Jesus three stinking times. And this guy stands up and he does what no fisherman ever does. He preaches out of the book of Joel. Fishermen don't know the book of Joel. I don't know the book of Joel. He stands up and he preaches. A nobody, a fisherman, the bottom of society. And he stands up and he preaches. And 3,000 people become Christians. None of the early church were highly educated. Can I point out to you that none of the early people of the early church had seminary degrees? None of them probably knew a whole great deal about much of anything. But for some crazy reason, in that period of time, friends, the church, the faith, the good news of Jesus, it went across the world like a wildfire. And friends, it was not because the church was educated. I believe in education. I teach in higher education. I believe in theology degrees. I believe in seminary degrees. Some of you are paying a lot of money for those degrees, and I believe in you. I celebrate you. But the hard part is this. When you look at the early church, the times that the church has grown the most have been the times in the church when it is least educated and most prayerful. When it depended on God. Nobodies, friends, these people were nobodies, and they're traveling the world and telling about this Jesus. And because they were telling about Jesus, friends, they didn't have the books, they didn't have the training, they didn't have the rhetoric degrees, they didn't have the seminary degrees, they didn't go to undergraduate, friends, they'd never taken their intro degree to world religions, they didn't know about other stuff. All they knew was that God was sending them into the world. In fact, I'm going to take a stand and say, I actually think that the times that the church grows the least are those times when we are the most educated. We grow best. Not when we have our degrees that I believe in. Not when we have all the right words. Friends, we grow not when we've read the right apologetic book and we know the right words. Friends, our message has power when we trust in God to open the door. I was at the Met in New York City this last week, and something caught my eye that I'd seen before, but I'd never paid attention to. Maybe you've seen this. Have you ever noticed early Christian art where Jesus is being held by Mary? Have you ever seen like a piece of art where Jesus is being held by Mary? And there's Mary, Mother of Jesus, holding Jesus in her arm. And when you look at those paintings, almost for the first 400, 500 years, 600 years, you'll notice something really weird with all of these paintings. And it even goes into the Renaissance period. I mean, it's almost ubiquitous. And it is this, that whenever Mary is holding Jesus, you will notice something very weird. Jesus is grabbing at her breast to drink. In fact, I was standing in one room, and picture after picture after picture, there is poor Mary. And Jesus just, I mean, picture after picture after picture of Jesus grabbing at the breast of Jesus. Or Jesus grabbing at the breast of Mary. And time and time and time again. And it's, I mean, friends, just go, it's all over. Go to the Met. Go to any art show that you can find yourself in. And look for the section, wherever the section is, where Jesus is being held by Mary. And I'll guarantee you 5 times out of 10, 1 time out of 2, whatever the numbers would be, that Jesus is grabbing at the breast of Mary. And it turns out, do you know why people, friends, people who've done those paintings and written about those paintings, do you know why people have painted that? It's this. Because when you imagine Jesus who breastfed at his mother's bosom, friends, when you think about that image, people in history time and again have been inspired by the vulnerability of God. In fact, that if you could define Jesus, this is what I think Jesus. My Young Life friends, Jesus is God in the bod. Okay. I'm going to put it this way. Jesus is God being vulnerable. And friends, Jesus, when for his 33 years of life, man, he would walk around, people would come up to him, he'd have conversations with people, they would be changed, he preached the kingdom, people would come and touch the hem of his robe. People would come chase after him. Friends, why in the world was Jesus so effective at helping people get God? Here is why. Here is why. It is because in the same way he was dependent on his mother's breast, he was dependent on his Father. Jesus was so vulnerable. He was so dependent. Jesus needed God to open the doors. Jesus didn't break the doors down. He needed God to open the doors. Jesus was God being vulnerable. Jesus was God being present and trusting that God was going to eventually have his way. You know what Jesus says in Matthew, in Luke chapter 10? Jesus is talking to his disciples. He's about to send them out into the harvest. And he says, pray to the Lord of the harvest. Pray to the Lord of the harvest. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Let me translate what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying right there, the issue isn't that people don't want God. The issue is there aren't enough of us who are willing to go out. You could read 100 books right now that would say God is dying in culture. You could read 100 books that say the church is dying. And I'm telling you, friends, I live in the most progressive neighborhood in our entire country. It goes between Boulder and Berkeley every 3 years, but Portland, I definitely know, is number one. And I'm telling you, God is not dying, and people's hunger for God is not dying. There are just not enough of us who are willing to go. And Jesus is saying, pray. He's being tricky here. He says, pray to the Lord of the harvest that he would send somebody in the worker field. He's actually saying, when you pray, it's you. He's being tricky. Jesus is being tricky. He's saying, pray to God that he'll send workers to the harvest. And before you even get done with that prayer, you realize it's you. It's you. It's you. God is not dead in our culture, friends. I cannot tell you how many of my non-Christian neighbors, one who's present in our room tonight, who is so, they can't even say it because they're afraid what ought to happen, but friends, they are so hungry for God, so hungry for God, and they don't know why. In the words of C.S. Lewis, friends, I gotta say, if there is no such thing as water, why are we thirsty? Friends, why are we all so hungry for God? God is not dying in our culture. The problem is, friends, we're just not willing to go. Notice Paul's vulnerability, his dependence. He says, pray that the message would come in, the doors would be opened. Pray that God would open the doors. Listen to that vulnerability. He is trusting God that God is going to open the doors to be able to share. Christian, number one thing you can do right here. Number one thing you can do to have good conversation with other people about Jesus. Number one thing. You ready? Number one, less script and more spirit. Put your script away. Don't have a conversation with somebody with a script perfectly written. Friends, go into a conversation and trust that the Spirit of God lives in you. Didn't Jesus say that to be true? He said, when you're put in front of magistrates, kings, and authorities, and you're questioned, don't worry about what you are going to say. The words will be given to you. Our problem is we don't trust that God's Spirit lives in us. You're wondering, what am I talking about? Star Wars. Do you remember the targeting computer? Luke, why did you turn off your targeting computer? My son watched Star Wars for the first time 3 weeks ago. It's been Star Wars in our house nonstop, every day. Friends, do you remember the targeting computer? Luke is in the first one, the best one. He's flying in. And he's got to get the bomb down in the middle of the Death Star, right in the middle. And he's got his you remember that cool targeting computer? It's like, this is like Google Glasses before everything existed, just like. And he's looking at it, the perfect spot where you're going to drop it in. And he's so close. And the voice, Luke, trust the Force. And he's like, that's the creepiest thing. What is that? Who's that? Is it the targeting computer? Or is it the Force? And he presses the best part in the movie. He presses the button. They call in, Luke, why have you turned off your targeting computer? No answer. And Luke just trusts in the Force. Why? Because he knew he had the Force. I don't mean to be cliche, friends, but Christians, you've got the Force. You have the Force. You don't need anything else. You have the Force. The Spirit of God lives in you. Stop trusting in your targeting computers. Turn it off. And when you're sitting with your neighbor who's seeking God, when you're sitting with your friend who's interested in Jesus, when you're sitting, here's what I want you to do. I want you to put your script away and be a human being in front of that person and trust the voice of God in your heart. It's the scariest thing to do. It is so flipping scary to not know what you're supposed to say. But I want to tell you, actually, in not knowing what you're supposed to say, your witness becomes real. My friend Steve Overman, who was my pastor for 10 years down in Eugene, you want to know how he became a Christian? This is how he became a Christian. He became a Christian. He was a student at the University of Oregon, philosophy major. The guy's far more brilliant than any human being I've ever met. And he was hitchhiking, and he got on a truck, and he got in the, somehow, shape or form, he got in the front of the truck, and he was having a conversation with the truck driver, and the truck driver tells him about Jesus. And my friend Steve says, well, I don't believe it. You got to answer this. What about the Bible and this and this? And that? Tell me where to go. And the truck driver, he says, my friend Steve says, the minute the guy said the next phrase, he became a Christian. The truck driver who's driving turns to him and he goes, I don't know. And my friend Steve said, the authenticity of somebody who's willing to know that they didn't know what to say, but they still love God, changed his life. Friends, here's the great news. Your ignorance preaches Jesus. When you don't know the answer, say, I don't know. But friends, when you do, baby, bring it. But when you don't, friends, we have thought for so long that being a Christian meant we have to have all the answers for everything. And I gotta tell you, to a generation of people who have really big BS meters, they know when we're lying. They know when we're lying. People know when we are just full of it. But to be able to say to somebody, I don't know the answer to that question. That's a great one. I should go read my Bible probably. Thanks for leading me back to Jesus. Friends, people say, I don't know. Paul is saying, pray to God that he opens the doors. It is liberating, friends, to realize that you do not have the power to open any doors. You only have power to walk through the ones that God opens. That's all you can do. You cannot force it. You can't fabricate it. You can only be faithful with it. I love the word watchful. He says, be watchful. Be watchful. I was in Cannon Beach about a month ago at a camp. And this young guy, I noticed this young guy by the name of Tyler, kept kind of I was preaching at this camp, and it was a family camp, so there were all sorts of people, Christians, non-Christians, you name it, everybody was there. And this young guy, after the service was all done, he kept sort of sitting around and waiting for me to kind of come and talk with him, but he didn't initiate anything, so I was, I think, being snarky, and I didn't want to press it, so I just sort of walked the other way, and he kept kind of waiting for me. And finally, at the end of the camp, it was like a day before the camp was done, and I just felt so strongly that this guy, I was just supposed to sit down with him and say, what's up, man? Evangelism was on 101. What's up? And he's sitting there, and I say, what's up? And he goes, can we do dinner tomorrow night? And I said, absolutely, let's do dinner tomorrow night. We sat down for dinner the next evening. And this guy sits down, and he goes, I came to camp with my family, and I've been a staunch atheist for the last 20 years of my life. And he goes, my father killed himself 5 years ago, and I've lost so much sleep because I cannot deal with the idea that there is nothing beyond this world. And he said, I can't shake God. I can't shake God. And I'm sitting there, friends, there's no class. I can't tell you to take a class at George Fox to tell people what happens when you're talking to an atheist whose dad died 5 years ago, he took his own life. There's no answer to that question. I just sat there and I put my hand on his shoulder and I said, you really want God, don't you? And he broke down, dude. And he said, I want God so bad, but I'm so scared. And I said, you don't need to be scared, dude. He loves you like a father. And I just got Billy Graham on him. I got Billy Graham. I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to pray the sinner's prayer. Just repeat after me. It's corny. It's dorky. Jesus, I'm a sinner. Jesus, I'm a sinner. He goes, I believe in you. I believe in you. Forgive me for sin. Forgive me for my sin. Amen. And he looks up at me, and he goes, what just happened? And I said, you let Jesus in. You're screwed. And he goes, this probably means that I'm a Christian now. And I said, you're absolutely a Christian now. And I said, we're going to baptize you. And I got all the people we could, and we went down to the ocean down there at Camp Beach, and we baptized him, and all these people were there. Didn't even know the guy. And he walked away a Christian, and he's a Christian now. And he's, like, going to church and stuff. And he's been texting me during church, like, man, I don't get church. The pastor's using words I don't get. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I mean, there's welcome to church, man. Like, that's the way it is. And he goes, the church is weird and different. People drink so much coffee around here and use words and have little vernacular like brother and sister. And I'm like, I swear it's not a cult, man. I swear. And this guy's growing in Jesus. He's reading his Bible. And I got to tell you, just friends, in that moment, none of my skills worked. The only thing that worked was I was just willing to sit down and talk. And your greatest witness is not going to be your fine-tuned language, your nuanced conversation. Friends, your greatest witness is that you sat down and you talked. Just be there. And don't have a script. Just whatever happens, just trust God. Always bring people back to Jesus. Yeah, Jesus, that's the one. Jesus. If you don't know the answer, Jesus. What should I do about this, Jesus? If you aim for Jesus, you'll probably never miss. May your conversation be full of grace. May your conversation be full of grace. What does that mean? Christian, non-Christian, what does that mean? May your conversation always be full of grace. Always full of grace. A friend of mine's a guidance counselor. And she was telling me about this idea that she's kind of been working with. She actually published a paper on it. She was telling me about this idea of how to motivate people and how to actually have good conversation. And she said, you know, every person, we always talk in three kinds of voices. She says the first kind of voice that we talk in is the child voice. And the child voice is kind of bottom voice. The child voice is this. The child voice is that voice that we have when we're talking to a superior. It's the voice of a child. It's the voice of my son when I say, clean your room up. And he's like, yes, Papa, you got it, Papa. It's the voice when I say, you've watched Star Wars 9 times today. We should stop, probably. And he goes, you're right, Papa. Brain coming out of his ear. Like, yeah, you're right, I shouldn't do that. Child voice is the voice of somebody below talking to somebody above. It's the voice of submission. And then there's this middle voice that she calls the parent voice. And a parent voice is the voice of somebody who's actually speaking down to somebody else. It's the voice of somebody who's superior to somebody else or believes themselves to be superior, speaking down to somebody else. It's my voice when I say to my son, you need to clean your room up. It's my voice sometimes when I preach to the church, when I say, dudes, you got to repent. Dudes, you got to stop. Dudes, you got to do this. Dudes, it's sometimes I have the parent voice, and I'm sorry about that. And he says, my friend says that those two voices are important voices, and they're voices that sometimes we have. But she says that there's a third voice. There's the child voice down here of the voice of somebody speaking up to somebody else. There's the parent voice of somebody speaking down to somebody else. And she says, but there's a third voice. And the third voice is this. She calls it the adult voice. And the adult voice is this. The adult voice is somebody who recognizes that they're speaking to somebody in mutuality who is a co-equal with whom you give great respect, and you are willing to dialogue back and forth as equals. There's child voice, parent voice, and adult voice. Here's my theory. The world resents the church so deeply because for so long we have been speaking to the world in parent voice. We have been speaking to the world down. In fact, if I look at why my LGBTQ neighbors are mad at the church, when I think about my gay friends, why they're mad at the church, more often than not, they are so hurt because they have felt for so long that they are spoken down to. When Paul says, speak always full of grace, I think he is inviting the church in the 21st century to know that their witness will primarily come with adult voice. To be able to speak in mutual, respectful, civil, gracious, kind ways. in a kind of relationship, friends, where we are able to witness to the name of Jesus, but we are simultaneously willing to learn from our neighbors. We're willing to listen. We're willing to be humble. We're willing to say we've been wrong. We're willing to acknowledge where we haven't known things we're supposed to know. We're willing to say we have not done what we're supposed to say. Friends, adult voice is our ability to proclaim boldly that Jesus is the way to God. But I want to learn from you too. And friends, for so long, the church has been speaking down to the world. We've been looking down at the world and pointing and saying, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. And I think Jesus is inviting his church to become humble and speak to the world respectfully and graciously. May your conversation always be full of grace. It is scary to talk in adult voice. Because in adult voice, you recognize you might be wrong. At times, you might have something to learn, friends. May your conversation always be full of grace. How does your conversation need to be full of grace? I would die for the idea, friends, that Jesus is the only way to God. I would die for the idea that Jesus is our hope. I would die for the idea, I would die for the truth that Jesus is the hope of the world. And I got to tell you why I'd die for that. I'd die for that because I've encountered so many things in my life. I have never encountered anybody or anything as graceful, as loving, as truth-telling, as forgiving, as gracious as Jesus. And I believe in Jesus with all my heart. I would die for him. And it's really hard to speak to the world humbly about something that you would die for. Jesus is the hope of the world. You're looking for God, Jesus is your hope. Turn to him, believe in him. What's awesome, friends, what's awesome about believing as Jesus is the only way to God means that you're not the only way to God. And neither am I. He is. It is all of our task, friends, to constantly turn to Jesus in all that we do. May your conversation always be full of grace. May it always bring people back to Jesus. May it always bring people back to Jesus. May it always bring us back to Jesus. Jesus is our hope. Jesus is our hope. The church isn't the hope of the world. Jesus is the hope of the world. And for so long, our conversations have not been full of grace. They've been full of condescension. They've been full of speaking down to people. They've been full of being mean. They've been full of being mean-spirited. And Jesus is inviting his church to speak to the world always full of grace. Devote yourself to prayer, thanksfulness, and watching. Why were people drawn to Jesus? Here's why. Do you notice how Jesus, people are always trying to find Jesus and they can't find him? Why? Because he's up in the mountains praying. He's with his father. He's worshiping. People can't find Jesus. They're frustrated. Disciples want to find Jesus. I think people were drawn to Jesus because Jesus was drawn to his father. People were drawn to Jesus because Jesus was drawn to his father. I think people are going to be drawn to us because we're drawn to Jesus. That our entire lives are worship. Entire lives are worship. The key to witness, friends, is worship. It is to us fully loving him with all of our hearts. That is the key to witness. There's no trick. There's no class. Are we being drawn to Jesus ourselves? When I was 16 years old, became a Christian, you know, one of the first worship songs I learned was, oh man, you're going to love this. Do you guys remember Ron Canole? Anybody in the 80s, 90s who came to faith in the 90s remembers Ron Canole? When I became a Christian at 16 years old, I've said this before, you know what I did? I worshiped all the time. That was the thing I loved. I worshiped all the time. I would just worship all the time. I would get every stinking CD I could get my hands on, and I would worship. And I remember I got Ron Canole's, I was 16 years old, got Ron Canole's Greatest Hits album. I love the greatest hits. Blessing and honor, glory and power be unto the Ancient of Days. From every nation, all of creation, bow before the Ancient of Days. Every tongue in heaven and earth. Oh my gosh. I would sit in my room, dude, and just Ron Canole it up. I would worship all the time. And when I was about 23 years old, I started going to seminary. And it was weird because when I started going to seminary, I stopped worshiping. I became embarrassed about the things I used to sing. I got quiet about those. I traded all that stuff for other stuff. I'd listen to Dave Matthews or whatever things at the time were acceptable. And I traded in all my worship. I stopped listening to that stuff and I started listening to other stuff because I was embarrassed. And in the last 6 months, I've brought back Ron Canole and Rich Mullins and DC Talk. And I'm in this new stage. I'm 35. I'm sitting upstairs in my room. I'm sitting down at night, and I'm just sitting there grooving to Ron Canole and singing to Jesus like the days I did when I was 16 before I got embarrassed with God. And I'm worshiping again. Paul Pastor said something to me a few weeks ago. He's a part of our church, and he said, the single greatest tool that we have for spiritual warfare is worship. It's to worship God. Return to your first love, church. What were the songs you sang when you were 16 that you're embarrassed about now that you need to sing again? Worship him. Go back to those old albums. Dust them off. Get that old Newsboys album. Get the Ron Canole out. Get the Rich Mullins out. And worship him the way you used to. We want the world to see Jesus. We got to worship. Worship. Don't be embarrassed. Jesus, we've been embarrassed of you for a while. Your church has been embarrassed. We've been like a parent in Disneyland with their parents, and the last thing we want to do in our teenagers is be seen with our parents. Jesus, for some of us, we're embarrassed. We're embarrassed of you, Jesus. We're embarrassed to sing of you. We're embarrassed to sing those songs. We're embarrassed to be associated with you. And maybe right now, God, you're speaking to us that you don't want us to be embarrassed. You want us to worship again. You want us to worship again. You want us to worship again. Jesus, we're proud to call ourselves by your name. You have saved us. You are worthy to be associated with. God, would you, just over the course of the next few weeks as we talk about what it means to be a witness, would the defenses that maybe some of us have about what that means be kind of lowered, and we be okay? We'd be okay having honest conversations about what it means to be witnesses in our city. Jesus, you love Portland. You love the city. You love Portland. You love Oregon. You're here. God, you love this place. You love Vancouver. You love this place. And you want your city to be salt. God, you want your church to be a light on the hill. You don't want us to sit, put ourselves in a bowl. God, you want us. You want us to shine. Jesus, teach your church to shine again. Teach your church to shine. May we shine, Jesus.
You've been listening to the podcast of Theophilus Church. We hope you've been inspired and challenged by what you've heard. For more information, visit our website at theophiluschurch.com.